the GIs. She was Hanoi Hannah.
American GIs, don't fight this unjust, immoral, and illegal war of Johnson. Get out of Vietnam now and alive. This is the Voice of Vietnam, broadcasting from Hanoi, capital of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. A program for American GIs can be heard at 1630 hours Saigon time.
Hello, I'm Scott Simon, and this is Vietnam Radio First Termer, a program from National Public Radio, produced by Interlock Media Associates in Boston. In this segment, we explore radio propaganda during the Vietnam War.
Listen in next time.
Get out while you are still alive. From Saigon, this is the American Forces Vietnam Network.
The men who are fighting for our nation and for what we believe in.
Hello, North America.
Germany calling. We're operating again over six nations.
Psychological warfare over the airwaves was not invented in Vietnam. Nazi Germany's creation, Lord Haw Haw.
We now present Lord Haw Haw speaking to England.
For 3 years, the democratic opponents of world progress, led by Churchill the charlatan and Roosevelt the renegade, have sought to substitute deeds, little deeds, with words. You'd better listen regularly, not miss a broadcast. You can't project the war's outcome unless you are informed on all of such significant factors as these.
Lord Haw Haw lectured in lofty tones, but Tokyo Rose took a more personal approach.
Hello, you fighting orphans of the Pacific? Hi, Six. This is after her weekend outing back on the air strictly under your name. Reception okay? Well, it better be, because this is all request night. And I've got a pretty nice program for my favorite little family, the wandering boneheads of the Pacific Islands. The first request is made by none other than the boss. And guess what? He wants Bonnie Baker and my existing figure. My, what taste you have, sir, he said.
Hanoi Hannah and Tokyo Rose do invite comparison, but their wars are very different. Ernest Holbright, a UPI bureau chief in Asia, remembers Tokyo Rose as having little impact on the morale of Allied troops.
Her broadcast might have had a terrific effect if our nation and our forces hadn't been so well unified. I mean, this was a war where everybody was in it, and everybody was on the same side. There wasn't the dissension, there wasn't the argument that we ran into in Vietnam about whether we should be there or not.
How are you, G.I. Joe? It seems to me that most of you are poorly informed about the going of the war, to say nothing about a correct explanation of your presence over here. Nothing is more confused than to be ordered into a war to die or to be maimed for life, without the faintest idea of what's going on.
Chuck Winer.
The first time I heard Radio Hanoi Hannah, was I was on guard duty one night down the Delta, just listening through the radio, flipping through the radio dial. And to my amazement, I got the enemy on the radio. I thought that was fascinating, so I listened quite regularly to it.
Hanoi Hannah held her audience with baseball scores, the latest music, and even hints of upcoming battles. And then came the editorials.
In the light of such historical facts and quotations, isn't it clear that the war makers are gambling with your lives while pocketing huge profits? Now, for Connie Francis singing, I Almost Lost My Mind.
I lost my baby. Oh, oh, oh.
I don't know any GI that kept a schedule of when Hanoi Hannah was going to broadcast.
Former ABC correspondent Don North.
But let's face it, war is about 98% boredom, sitting around waiting for something to happen. And certainly at night, after a few beers, then you might twiddle the dial of a radio if you've got one. Inevitably, Hanoi radio may come up. And if it's at all intelligible, you'll listen to it for a while. And maybe even think about some of the things they say.
You are a long, long way from Port Riley now. And there is no Jersey cafe in town on Washington Street where you can sit around the counter eating hamburgers and sipping coffee without having to be afraid a bomb might go off, like it did at that restaurant in Saigon a few weeks back. You can get killed here. Get out while you are still alive and before it's too late.
Everybody knew that was the Mekong restaurant that had been blown sky high, and there were about 50 GI casualties. It was well known. These were incidents that GIs could relate to.
The news about the war in North and South Vietnam. South Vietnam. On July the 13th, four U.S. Navy helicopter crewmen were killed.
The United States never could give you a true estimate of the total losses for, say, a day per week, you know, not even a month. They wouldn't even attempt to give you that. But Hanoi Hannah will wake you up in the morning telling you, okay, the 2nd or the 25th was wiped out. She knew where every unit was in Vietnam.
The 1st Air Cavalry Division was hit by ground fire and crashed.
Veteran Rene Parker.
Before you, you know, walk out your hooch, get out your trench. Now she's giving you, you know, a warning. She's like letting you know ahead of time that it ain't no tomorrow for you.
Not everyone gave Hanoi Hannah as much credence. Veteran Jerry Clark.
Every time she talked about the heavy losses that were inflicted upon a unit, you couldn't really accept her word for it, because she would say things like, well, today we eliminated 70, you know, men from the 173rd, and there may have been one guy wounded. They may not even have had any contact that day. But, you know, she just gave out some statistics that you had to take with a grain of salt.
Casualties in Vietnam, Army, Corporal Larry J. Samples, Hennegar, Alabama. Staff Sergeant Charles R. Miller, Tucson, Arizona. Sergeant Frank G. Herrera, Coolidge, Arizona.
The depth of detail of what Hanoi Hannah knew and the speed with which she broadcast it made her seem psychic to American GIs. Tom Wallace, who served 10 years in Special Forces, remembers one chilling incident.
We had a lieutenant. He had turned 22 years old, and they wanted him to come down to celebrate his 22nd birthday at the headquarters. He got in a sampan, one of the Vietnamese boats, with a couple of security guards, and they started down the river, and in a narrow area, one of the enemy reached out and handed them a hand grenade and killed the three of them in the boat. We found the boat later, and we found a birthday card pinned to the lieutenant's chest saying, you know, happy 22nd birthday, this is your last. A day or two later, we picked up a radio broadcast from Hanoi Hannah saying that congratulations to Lieutenant so-and-so. I understand he had a big bang with his 22nd birthday, and it is too bad he will no longer be with his, make his 23rd birthday, and so on and so forth.
Hanoi Hannah would regularly air testimonies from captured American pilots and defectors.
He asked for permission to send a message to his wife. His request granted, he spoke with tears in his voice.
My darling, sweetheart, I am recording this only to tell you, sweetheart, that I am alive in a well, and that someday I will be home. Take care of the boys. You are all on my mind, always.
Gunther wept like a child. Soon his grief turned into anger. He spoke with bitterness. I don't believe in killing people. I don't believe in this war. As a military man, I just followed orders. I want to speak out my opposition now. It's my belief that we should leave Vietnam and let the Vietnamese people mind their own business. Poor Gunther. It's too late for him to come out against this senseless war now.
I remember sitting in a tent with about 13 guys from Charlie Company, 1-7. We were all on mess duty.
Veteran Mike Roberts.
One guy kept saying, "Hey, man, be quiet, be quiet." He says, "There's a riot, man. There's a riot in Detroit. There's a riot in Detroit." And everybody stopped, you know. And, an Armed Forces radio was saying, "Yeah, there's been a riot in Detroit. There was some loss of lives, you know." Armed Forces radio did not give you, or I didn't hear them give an in-depth account of what precipitated it, what transpired. Hanoi Hannah comes on soon after that. She knows the names of people who were killed. Okay. What kind of weapons were used. You know what I'm saying? I'm sure there were some guys who felt if she took the time out to speak about such things, why couldn't our own do the same, you know? That was really the first time that I started hearing her overtly call upon blacks to, you know, rethink their situation there. You know, why are you fighting? You know, you have your own war, you know, your own battle to fight, you know, in America, you know.
Now for our talk, a Vietnam black GI who refuses to be victim of racism. His name is Billy D. Smith, March the 15th. On that morning, a fragmentation grenade went off in an officer's barrack in the Bien Hoa Army base, killing two gung-ho lieutenants and wounding a third. Smith was illegally searched, arrested, put in Long Binh jail, then brought home for trial. The evidence that clearly shows him guilty of all charges and specifications is this. Being black, poor, against the war and the army, and refusing to be a victim of racism.
But Hanoi Hannah did not always succeed in playing on racial tensions among the ranks. Mike Roberts.
The majority of guys realize that Hanoi Hannah, regardless of how informative she was, how soothing or how sensitive she may have appeared to be, you know, to the oppressed, was still the enemy. I don't care how you want to cut it. She was still broadcasting from Hanoi. And if you thought that you could just say, "Well, I think I'll go see her tomorrow and we'll sit down and have a cup of coffee," you know, blah, 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 and everything would be hunky-dory, you were out of your mind. You know, it just wasn't like that.
Jimmy Cliff coming up, and we'll see you tomorrow. This is John Gabriel, and this is The Morning Show on WPAX.
Not only the North Vietnamese broadcast their views over Radio Hanoi, American anti-war activist Abby Hoffman produced several programs for Radio Hanoi with a group that included poet John Giorno.
I got a phone call one day from Abby saying, "John, I got this great idea called WPAX, and it's making radio programs by us here in New York for broadcast on Radio Hanoi in Vietnam to the troops in South Vietnam." And so we made these programs, which basically, which is like alternate radio here, like BAI or anything. I mean, there was all the music that wasn't broadcast, which was The Who and Janis Joplin and all those endless songs that weren't permitted on Armed Forces Radio. point was just to give information to the guys fighting in Vietnam, which was the same information that we were getting here, giving them the culture that was happening now.
It's time for WPAX News. Jane Fonda, Donald Sutherland, and Dick Gregory are among a number of entertainers who have formed a comedy troupe in the hope of touring military bases across the country and in Vietnam with an anti-war stage show.
As we sort of gained momentum and had meetings in Paris with the North Vietnamese and everything, it got sort of more exposure. And then that's when Spiro Agnew started calling us the would-be Hanoi Hannahs, the would-be Tokyo Roses, the Hanoi Hannahs, the would-be Tokyo Roses. And then it got sort of a bit serious about September when they actually had issued arrest warrants for a couple of us.
The U.S. government had propaganda efforts of its own, which included distributing messages in matchbooks and dropping billions of leaflets over Vietnam.
It turned out that aside from dropping leaflets, they had people who would go out in the field with these loudspeaker packs on their backs. And you'd have a little Vietnamese friend who spoke Vietnamese, because none of us did. None of us had gone to language school.
When he first arrived in Vietnam, Scott Manning was assigned to a psychological operations, or PSYOPS, unit.
You'd be there with these loudspeakers on your back, and this little guy would be telling the guys on the other side that they ought to give up. You know, just put your hands in the air, throw the gun down, come on over. Of course, the speaker was really a great target. Even if they couldn't see you, they knew just right where you were.
Roger Steffens was a sergeant in another PSYOPS campaign.
In the early part of 68, we were building PSYOP radio stations, 250,000-watt transmitters around the country. And we had little plastic radios that were just a little bit bigger and thicker than a pack of cigarettes. And we dropped hundreds of thousands of them over the Central Highlands, and they were only tunable to one station, and that was the PSYOP station.
Instructions attached to some of the radios were printed in Vietnamese, which few of the native Montagnard Highlanders could read. Other psychological operations were more sophisticated. So-called black propaganda broadcasts attempted to mislead enemy troops by carefully imitating enemy radio stations. Lauren Sole, co-author of the book Clandestine Radio Broadcasting, credits General Edward Lansdale, the first CIA chief in Vietnam, with setting up U.S. black propaganda programming there.
In 1954, after the French were defeated, General Edward Lansdale was sent to Vietnam to determine whether or not a government that would oppose the North Vietnamese could be established, that is, a democratic government. Lansdale went in, investigated the situation, and threw his support behind Diem. Part of that support for Diem included the operation of clandestine radio stations, including a black version of Hanoi Radio, and during 1955, the operation of clandestine radio stations like People's Radio and Radio of the Republic.
Former CIA agent Frank Sniff.
Well, some of the early black radio operations, really black, with the broadcast being presented as something coming out of Radio Hanoi, were very dangerous, because what happens was that only a few people in the U.S. government were aware of the U.S. government sponsorship of these broadcasts. So they would be viewed as a legitimate topic for intelligence analysis. You have American analysts analyzing, without realizing it, the product of American propaganda. And you would get a skewed perspective on a strategic issue.
During this period, the U.S. was also using clandestine radio propaganda closer to home. Lauren Sole.
So the policy that was developed by Lansdale in Vietnam in the middle 1950s continued into the 60s and took place in Latin America and directed against Cuba in particular. In fact, Lansdale was in charge of that.
Lansdale left Vietnam in the early 60s, but his protege, Theodore Shackley, became CIA station chief in Vietnam. Denise Healy, formerly called My Lawn, hosted a CIA-sponsored clandestine program, Mother Vietnam, aimed at enemy soldiers. She encouraged her CIA sponsors to adopt a more personal approach to radio propaganda.
I knew that the hardcore propaganda could not work because no one really wants to have someone else coming into you, pounding your head and tell you what to do.
Each day, she spent a portion of her program reading letters written by North Vietnamese mothers to their sons.
What we have for who to work with was sometimes letters that they send down to the North Vietnamese soldiers, and we pick it up from, you know, from their bodies, and then we have to read those letters and also make known to what their concerns were, and what would be their expectations or longings and hopes. So we just used what we could find via intelligence work. You know, you want to project an image of a mother calling out for her children. She was desperate.
War correspondent and filmmaker Don North.
I think the first criterion of an effective propagandist is that you hold your audience, that your audience comes back and keeps listening to you. They don't tell all the facts, and they don't give their casualties, for instance, but they don't lie purposely. And so they've built up credibility with both the rural population, the people whose hearts and minds they're trying to win, and the foreign news media.
Frank Sniff.
Based on our discussions with ralliers and prisoners, there was no enduring audience for American-generated propaganda aside from Mother Vietnam. The best propaganda is what is closest to the truth, with just a poison peanut or two tossed into the mix, piece of disinformation. But in Vietnam, because the listenership on the communist side was so haphazard, that approach to propaganda didn't work.
Okay, the lesson of Vietnam is that superior military force won't prevail.
Howard Frederick is a professor of international telecommunications at Ohio University.
You need to destabilize, you need to confuse and sow doubt, you need to divide and isolate the people from the revolutionary movement. You need to neutralize them in order to win them over. And in this case, opinion formation and disinformation are key components in this strategy.
According to Frederick, operations like Mother Vietnam set a precedent for modern-day U.S. propaganda.
In fact, the Pentagon now has four battalions of psychological operations troops based at Fort Bragg, which are available for immediate action and have seen action in Angola, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. These troops have at their disposal airplanes which carry portable 50,000-watt transmitters, satellite antenna, film projectors on the back of trucks, printing presses, film development, photography labs, all that can be rolled out of one plane and set up and immediately go into action.
Frank Schnitt.
Many of the people who are in Vietnam who got their operational experience there left government in the early 80s and became privatized espionage operatives, and they took all they had learned and they began applying it under contract to U.S. government interests.
Two decades later, another part of the world had a different language. Contra-operated Radio Liberacion broadcast to Sandinista soldiers with a transmitter reported to be located in neighboring El Salvador. Like Hanoi Hannah, like Mother Vietnam, Radio Liberacion calls upon enemy soldiers to give up their weapons and surrender.
Nicaragüenses de servicio en la aviación sandinista.
Brother Nicaraguans in Sandinista Air Force, we ask you not to fly helicopters over war zones dominated by the Nicaraguan resistance. We have got them targeted, and it is very easy for us to destroy them. We don't want fellow Nicaraguans to continue dying. Brothers in the Sandinista Air Force, we invite you to take that helicopter you are flying to the border of a neighboring country. Do it right now, before it is too late.
Barry Zorthian headed the Joint U.S. Public Affairs Office responsible for coordinating official information on the war.
I think the world today in Vietnam was a demonstration of this. It's become so communication heavy, if you will. Communications is so pervasive that you must accept a situation and an atmosphere of complete openness, classification, suppression of information in whatever form is virtually impossible. And so openness, surfacing of facts, accuracy in your information, and honesty are critical, not just because that's morally right, but because it's right in practical terms, too.
Veteran Chuck Leinert sees a direct application today for what he heard on Radio Hanoi.
The Vietnamese made the mistake of assuming that their foes were politically motivated, a politically aware organization that knew what it was doing and why it was doing it, as opposed to what it was. We didn't know what we were doing or why we were doing it. They spoke to us in the Marxist-Leninist line, and that's not going to go over with 18-year-old kids, 19-year-old kids off the street. They just don't know what you're talking about. But it struck me when it became clear that the U.S. was seriously going to mess with the Sandinistas that a bunch of GIs, ex-Vietnam vets, talking over the radio about our own experiences in Vietnam and playing the best rock and roll in Latin America, we could seriously mess with the man's war effort. And that's what we were trying to do. We got a lot of support for it, but anybody out there got a transmitter? I need a 30,000-watt transmitter to pull it off.
Jonathan Schwartz is executive producer for the Vietnam Radio First Termer series from Interlock Media Associates in Boston. The program is based largely on original research by co-producer Alexis Milner. NPR executive producer is Frank Tavares. George Holmesy and NPR's Corey Huss are the associate producers. First Termer was mixed by Frank Cunningham at WGBH in Boston. It was edited and engineered by Joshua Weinman, Robert Connolly, Monty McGuire, Charles Rosina, Rick Wolf, David Lavalle, and Jim Moses. Theme music by Paul Roost. Voiceover and translation by Diego Arcenegas. Project staff includes Kate Atkinson, Barbara Bernstein, Robert Dickinson, Ann Harrison, Kristen Amberling, Ricardo Ray, Chris Bailey, and Laura Crosby. Writing and editorial assistance from William Lichtenstein, Robert Dietrich, Beth Harrington, Tom Watkins, Judy Roddenbeck, and Robin Washington. Also special thanks to the following stations for the use of their facilities: KCRW in Santa Monica, California, WUSF, Tampa, Florida, KWIT, Cedar Falls, Iowa, and WRMS and WJNO in West Palm Beach, Florida. Also, we gratefully acknowledge the many individuals and organizations who opened their archives to first-termer researchers and veterans organizations nationwide who provided invaluable assistance. The series was produced in cooperation with Boston's Public Media Foundation. Funding has been provided by the Fund for Tomorrow and Club Computer, the Massachusetts Foundation for the Humanities and Public Policy, the Massachusetts Council on the Arts and the Humanities, the William Joyner Center for the Study of War and Social Consequences at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and NPR member stations. I'm Scott Simon. This is NPR National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air.
That's the West End Jazz Band, and you'll hear lots of groups just like that as we present an hour of recordings from the Stomp Off label this Sunday morning at 11. This is Ted Howes. Please join me, won't you, here at the Jazz Band Ball on Buffalo's number one station for jazz, WBFO.
How did sign on the first morning that you did your show?
The same as I did every other one. We would have a little bit of music from an album called Like Tweet by Joe Puma and the Audiobon All-Stars. And then I would say, "Good morning, Vietnam," and then start into the program that way.
That was Adrian Cronauer. In 1965, he used to wake up the troops in Vietnam with his early morning Armed Forces radio show. Now Robin Williams uses Cronauer's famous sign-on in the new movie Good Morning Vietnam. Williams stars as Adrian Cronauer, the DJ who brought top 40 music to the Armed Forces radio service in Saigon. When Cronauer's tour of duty was up, he returned to the States and continued working in broadcasting. Now, at the age of 49, he's changing careers. He's a second-year law student at the University of Pennsylvania. Cronauer came to Vietnam after doing an Armed Forces radio show on the island of Crete. I asked him what the radio station in Saigon sounded like when he got there.
If you've seen the film, you'll notice at the very beginning, there was a very dull, dry, boring, soporific announcement about how to get your hold baggage if you'd lost your duffel bag or your trunk out of Tonsonute Air Base. That is as accurate a depiction as is humanly possible of what the station sounded like when I got there. And one of my aims was just to make it sound more like a stateside station.
Now, from seeing the film Good Morning Vietnam, it's my impression that before you came and did your show, that the popular music show was mostly Mantovani, Perry Como, Ray Conniff.
I think that's a lot of that is Hollywood exaggeration. Sure, there was that. But it was the overall sound of the station I was concerned with. And again, in the film, it seems as though the power structure of the military was violently opposed to this, and that wasn't the situation at all. It was more a matter of apathy. The general attitude seemed to be, well, gee, it sounds perfectly fine to me the way it is. Why are you making waves? It's not broke. Stop trying to fix it.
Did you get an immediate reaction from the soldiers who were listening to your show?
No. The reaction that's shown in the film is way overblown. We did not get mailbags full of letters and cards, and we did not have a bank of phones taking requests. First of all, there was no place where anybody could phone in from anyway. But secondly, there was a reaction that I would get mostly when I went out into the field. We would get an occasional card and letter, but if I go out doing interviews, people would say, "You're who?" And I'd say, "Cronauer." And they'd say, "Oh, yeah, I think I'm..." And I'd say, "Good morning, Vietnam." "Oh, yes, of course." And I found out later on that many times the GIs, although the program was popular and they enjoyed it, if I'd do the "Good morning, Vietnam" on a particularly bad day, they'd boo and hissed, and occasionally some would yell at their radio the GI equivalent of, "Get stuffed, Cronauer."
What did you play the most when you were on the air?
Whatever happened to be currently popular. Again, looking at what were the popular songs in the States and assuming that the GIs who came over from the States would want to hear what's popular back at home. Our whole idea was, whether it was in the music policy or the production that we did on the air, it was to make it sound as much as possible like a stateside radio station, to give them a little link with home as a morale factor.
Those of us who weren't in Vietnam have very vivid images, images from movies, for instance, from Apocalypse Now, where there's rockets going off in the air and bombs and the Doors are playing in the background. Do you think that you had something to do with bringing rock and roll to Vietnam?
I probably had my small part to play, as every person who worked at AFRS did. I don't think that I was the catalyst or the significant moving force in getting rock and roll in Vietnam. I think rock and roll got to Vietnam because rock and roll is the kind of music that is popular. It was popular then, and it still is. And so it would make little sense to try and put up a station that was a morale factor without having rock and roll on it, sure.
In the movie, the Robin Williams version of Adrian Cronauer is censored when he wants to read the real news that comes across the wire. All the news that comes over the wire is first presented to censors. And in the movie, the character witnesses a bombing at a restaurant that a lot of the army men hang out in, and he's not allowed to mention that on the air. Similar things happen to you?
On the subject of censorship, the movie is very accurate, except in one small detail. We did not have censors on premises at the stations. It was done by phone. But there was indeed a restaurant called the Mekong Floating Restaurant. It was built on a boat that was moored in the Saigon River, and one evening I had dinner there with some friends from the station, and after dinner we were still hanging out in the area when the Viet Cong sprayed the boat with shrapnel from a Claymore mine. And then about 3 or 4 minutes later, when everyone was panicking and trying to get off the boat, they aimed another Claymore mine directly at the gangplank and did a lot of carnage. And I heard the report of the explosion and the commotion and went back to see what was going on, tried to help out a bit, and then went back to the station to see if I could put the item on the air. And I called the duty officer for permission to put the story on the air and was denied permission, and I asked for a reason, and he said, "We have no official confirmation of this happening yet." And I explained that I had been there in person, had seen it within my own eyes, and the answer was still, "No, we have no real confirmation of any casualties." And I said, "Sir, with my own eyes, I've seen heads severed from torsos. Barring the second coming, they will not get up and walk away." And the final answer was no, and the final reason was, "Well, suppose we're wrong."
So you didn't
No, I did not go lock myself in the studio and put it on anyway, no. In fact, there are a lot of things in that movie that Robin does. If I had actually done them, I would have been court-martialed and I'd still be in Leavenworth.
When you were on the air, were there any signs in the control room that there was actually a war going on?
It was basically a traditional, ordinary, run-of-the-mill radio station control room. The only real reminder of the war was the fact that on the console, beside the turntables, was a loaded 45. Over in the newsroom, there was another one beside the teletype machines, and we were instructed that if it was necessary, we were expected to use it.
You were in Vietnam in 1965, and that was the year that the war really escalated.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the things that you saw that made you realize that the war was really changing?
When I got to Saigon in May of 65, it was a sleepy little French colonial town. And in 1 year's time, I saw it turn into a nightmare. The massive influx of American personnel, equipment, armament, money turned the city upside down. When I left, the black market was flourishing, the economy was in disarray, the traffic was unmanageable, the entire city was ridiculous. And although I found it a very enjoyable place to be when I first got there, in the context of that it was a war going on, I was very glad to get out.
When was the first time that you saw the movie, Good Morning Vietnam?
In October, I went out to California with my wife, and we saw The Rough Cut. And then in the middle of December, it premiered in New York, and we saw the finished product there.
What was your reaction the first time you saw the completed movie?
Well, for about 5 minutes or so, it was difficult to get used to the idea that, well, that's Adrian Cronauer up there, but I'm Adrian Cronauer, but he's me, but I'm here. And then finally, I just settled down and said, "All right, relax, enjoy the movie."
Well, Adrian Cronauer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Here is Adrian Cronauer, as played by Robin Williams.
Good morning, Vietnam! Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll. Time to rock it from the Delta to the DMZ. Is that me, or does that sound like an Elvis Presley movie? Viva Da Nang. Oh, viva Da Nang. Da Nang me, why don't they get a rope and hang me? Hey, is it a little too early for being that loud? Hey, too late. It's 0600. What's the O stand for? Oh, my God, it's early. Speaking of early, how about that Cro-Magnon? We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air.